Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I'm here with Josh Wesson. Josh, I've known for many years now. I remember the first time he came into Del Anima, and I was in a little bit of star shock. It was pretty awesome. Someone I've looked up to in the industry for quite a while.
I'm taller than you, that's why.
Maybe just a little bit. Josh, over the years, has become a good friend, but before his time coming into Del Anima, he had accomplished quite a bit. had been a sommelier, an assistant sommelier at the Quilted Giraffe, great restaurant, one of the really game-changing new American restaurants here in New York City. Had gone on to run a wine program and won all sorts of awards, best sommelier in America, went on to travel and do wine competitions, and then eventually ended up opening up a real game-changing retail store called Best Sellers, which he successfully ran for many years before cashing out. And so now I can only assume Josh just sits on the beach and sips some fine wine and...
It's true. I've been cultivating a tan for some years now.
No, that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean,
it's true. Look at me. Look how white I am.
You're so white. But you know, any wine and food event around, and I look at the talent, and for sure, you're the most highly sought after wine speaking talent at this point. It's you at every event.
I mean, I love to talk. I love to talk about wine and food, like you. I'm completely devoted to getting people excited about what they eat and drink, and leading them to the promised land of deliciousness. You know, we're sort of twins separated at birth by a number of years. Although you're the better looking twin,
you're the funnier and smarter.
Well, well okay, together we're like the comedy team of Chip and Dale. You know what we don't you know come down from the Temple Mount holding you know these keys, these commandments that tell people what to drink, what to eat, how to live their lives, how to get pleasure out of being at the table. We just try to give people the tools to make those decisions for themselves, and in the same time expand their universe of experiences. And it's been a lifelong pursuit for me, and it's never over. You know, one of the great things, I'm sure you feel the same way I do, there are no wine experts and there are wine and food experts, because the journey never ends. And even though I'm not working in restaurants anymore, I'm still completely and utterly devoted to taking people, you know, beyond their comfort zone and giving them experiences that hopefully will be long-lasting and rewarding and informing of things that they'll eat and drink long after they ever hang out with me.
You know? Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. I find that every time I learn more, it makes me realize how little it is I know. Like, oh, wow, that is a whole field of wines I had no idea about. That's a whole field of study or part of viticulture I had absolutely no idea. I remember when I learned about how great the wines in the Canary Islands could be, and I was like, these are some just world-class, thrilling wines, and I didn't even know they existed. I didn't know there were wines being made here at all. What are some of your recent discoveries that you're really excited about?
Well, you
about?
Talk about Canary Islands. You go to wacky islands that look like the moon, and you suddenly discover that there are wines being made there, and not just wines for the sake of novelty, but these wines are compelling and interesting and have histories that need to be understood and absorbed and then retold, because these wines aren't like other wines. And I just came back from the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, had a fantastic time there, did a number of seminars with some great chefs. I worked with Hedy Goldsmith, who is the the executive pastry chef for Michael's Genuine, you know, probably the greatest restaurants in Miami. And there's
anytime I'm in Miami, I go to Michael's Genuine. Great wine list, just great, fun, upbeat vibe. And they have heirloom tomatoes in February.
you go to Homestead and you don't want to leave. It's incredible. So, you know, Hetty's this wonderful, out-of-the-box thinking pastry chef. And she did some meat candy, which I thought was brilliant, by actually candying slices of artisanal bacon. And, you know, it challenged me to pair wines with all of these, you know, delicious things that were kind of crazy. She did a version, an artisanal version of a Snickers bar, and I paired it with a Lustau PX Sherry, and it blew people's minds. It blew my mind, because it's very hard when you have something that's that sweet and that intense and peanutty and caramelly and salty, and just to find a wine that can stand up to the assault of all those things. And it really was, you know, palate opening and mind opening for all the people that were tasting the wines and the desserts. But, you know, probably the match of the day was a Madeira. You know, talking about wines that come from forgotten islands. These wines were used to toast, you know, the signing of the Declaration of Independence. This was Jefferson's favorite wine. It was the dominant wine of that time. And
the oldest wine that we serve at the restaurants is Madeira, without a doubt.
Yeah. You know, but when you taste, I particularly like Momsey Madeiras, because I like the sweeter side of the spectrum of Madeira. And she made a chocolate cake that had three different elements in it that were sort of sweet and savory. There was a curry in there. There were elements of shallots. There was some cumin and hot spice. And it was just crazy savory sweet. And this Madeira that we had, it was just, you know, a simple Sandemann rich, was just, you know, just mind-bending, incredible, phenomenal.
So you are, as I guess everyone can tell, it without a doubt an expert in at least, if not, at least in food and wine pairing. You're the person that I look to. You've written about it. You've been quoted many times. You do a ton of events on it. The one food and wine pairing that I have such a hard time with, and you've been hitting on it with your seminar here, and I'd love to hear more about it, is pairing with sweets, just pairing with desserts. I personally, I guess the common thinking is that you want to pair something that's a little bit richer, a little bit sweeter than the dessert itself, so it doesn't make the wine seem, you know, flabby or you know, doesn't lose the wine. But I tend to not like such sweet things in general. What's your thought process when you're pairing a sweet wine with a dessert?
Well, you mentioned the received wisdom. The received wisdom is that when you have sweet foods, you need to find some equivalent level of sweetness in the wine, because it's counterintuitive, but when you have sweetness in food and sweetness in wine, they're subtractive. They don't add together to be more sweet on the palate. They actually cancel one another out. Mm-hmm. And if you have a wine that just has a kiss of sweetness and a food that's much sweeter than the wine, you can diminish the sweetness to the point where you crush the fruit in the wine, and then you focus on other elements in there, whether it's the acid or the tannin or the alcohol, and it sort of warps and woofs the balance into something that's not particularly tasty. But I don't like to get too heavy-handed the way, you know, you're just mentioning, avoiding, you know, these giant flavors like sumos battling, you know, for your palate's, you know, possession. I like to work with desserts that are either outrageously sweet, with wines that are outrageously sweet, like the PX Sherry and the Snickers bar, or back off and go into the world of savory sweet desserts, which I think are much more interesting than fully blown, ridiculously sweet desserts. Because you're right. Once you get into that level of sweetness, your hands are tied a bit when it comes to pairing with wine. But if you're talking about sweet savory foods, you've got a whole opportunity to pair wines and foods together that, you know, it's almost limitless. And, you know, riffing on that, going beyond desserts and dessert wine, I love savory foods that have elements of sweetness, whether it's barbecue sauce going on top of, you know, some ribs, or even, you know, artisanal ketchup on a burger. I mean, there's so many different things that we eat in the course of an everyday, you know, set of dining experiences that are sweet and savory at the same time. And those pose challenges that you and I love to take on.
Love that. And then when you see that kind of challenge in a more savory food, What are you immediately thinking? How do you tackle a burger with a sweet, acidic, homemade ketchup?
Well, you know, I've lately been on a kick. I just came back from Paris, And, you know, if you go around to all of these new bistros in Paris or hipster wine bars, and by the way, Paris now looks, for the most part, like Bushwick. It's exactly like Brooklyn. You go to the 11th arrondissement, the 10th, the 4th, you're in the Marais, you'd swear that you're synapsing right to Brooklyn. They're kind of catching up to us in an interesting way. But natural wines are very big there. And a whole raft of Pétillon wines that come from places like, you know, the Savoie, Jura, the Loire, wines that are just a little bit fizzy, but, you know, naturally so. And I'm crazy for slightly fizzy wines. I'm crazy for Lambruscos. I mean, I just, whether they're Amabile or, you know, full-blown Dolce or just, you know, Secco, I think these are the universal antidotes to all sorts of foods. And if I was shipwrecked on a desert island and I could only have one bottle float up on shore, it would be a sparkling red wine with a kiss of sweetness. I think that goes with everything.
Yes, I totally agree. I think that a lot of times those wines represent excellent value as well. And you find a lot of those more natural producers leaning on those kind of wines because a lot of times these Pétillon Naturel wines, you don't have to add another dose of yeast to it. You're doing one fermentation and just capturing the natural bubbly essence from that first fermentation. And I find that a lot of natural winemakers are doing that. And then, yeah, and from these off the beaten path kind of areas with cool grapes that you don't see, they're just thrilling and just utterly drinkable wines. You could just quaff them back.
You're crazy. You know, I mean, people talk about session beers, you know, beers that you can sit and drink the entire day. But these are wines that are, for the most part, fairly modest in alcohol, and they don't bang you over the head with acidity or sweetness or tannin or anything. They're just beautifully balanced, easy drinking. You could serve these to lunching orthodontists. they wouldn't mess up their afternoon cases. I mean, it's just, these wines are great. You know, hook them up with an IV drip if you can't sleep. They'll put, it's better than an Ambien. You know, they're ridiculously good. And I'm sure that you serve a bunch. I mean, I've had all sorts of really interesting, slightly effervescent wines in your restaurants. You're crazy for them, too.
We have, by the glass at La Pietra, we have the Camillo Donati Malvasia, which is both an orange wine, so they do a skin maceration before the fermentation is complete, and it's a Pétillon Naturel and unfiltered. So that is, like, that is, I think, would probably fit well into that Paris
wine. It's like
wine
you check, it's like, yeah. E, all of the above. A, B, C, D, E. Now, I would tell you, I am not a huge fan of oxidized white wines. Mm-hmm. I admire some of them. Some of them are super funky. It's an acquired taste for sure. But that was one thing that I noticed when I was in Paris, that I thought they were pushing the envelope a little bit too far and then licking. You know, it's just, you know, you can't get dogmatic about anything in wine. You can't hook, you know, your wagon to a train that won't let you, you know, jump tracks and go into other directions. And I think if you believe that orange wines are, you know, the next big thing, and that's the way you want to take people, you know, you're going to, you know, take people in a couple of directions they probably don't want to go. What do you think about orange wines? I mean, you tell me. Yellow, orange, blue, green.
No, I mean, very excited about orange wines, and our first wine list that I wrote at Dell'Anima, we had them by the glass. We've had them by the glass ever since at all of the restaurants. But at the end of the day, there are just as many orange wines that I think are terribly faulty and just not interesting or exciting as I do that I think that are thrilling. So it still has to be a really well made, really good wine. And I think when you make wine in that style, it really shows any of your flaws in the vineyard in winemaking, because you're not hiding anything. You know, when you make white wine, the skins are not as important as for red wine. So if you have some moldy fruit, you take it off the skins and you have the juice, and it's generally not as much of a problem. But when you're doing orange wine and you're using the skin, you really have to have, like, perfectly, perfectly healthy fruit. And you have to have really great vineyard practices, and you have to have a really healthy yeast population so that you can finish that fermentation. Otherwise, your wines just become off and faulty. And I do think that a lot of people... The other thing, you know, the other thing about orange wines is that since it is trendy, a lot of people are experimenting with them and then releasing experiments before they have many years to perfect it. So if you're not one of the greatest practitioners and you're just trying out something new, it's not going to be an exciting wine. It's not going to be as great as, you know, someone who's been making wine in the Mosel for seven generations.
Right. You know, sometimes you got to go with history. And you know, I've been going with history lately. You know, it's funny how things that you you fell in love with when you first came to wine can be forgotten in the wake of the next big thing or the next little thing or the next area that you've discovered that you didn't know about before. I fell in love with wine because of Beaujolais. And now I've come back to Beaujolais, Cru Beaujolais. I think the greatest values in the wine world are coming out of Beaujolais. And I was with Daniel Jonas for one night in Paris. He was coming up from Bordeaux, and he said he needed to have an antidote to drinking all of this Cabernet and Merlot. So we were in this little bistro. We had some Cru Beaujolais, just a bunch of different bottles on the table. And, you know, it's insane. Artisanal Cru Beaujolais that's not, you know, carbonically macerated, real deal. You can get the best versions of those wines in a store for $25 or $30, on a wine list in a restaurant for $50. And it's the best expression of that kind of wine. And these wines are gymnastically flexible with food. They're so bendy, they go with everything. I mean, I'm crazy for this stuff.
And these wines have so much in common with Burgundy, which is just far up north, the elegance and the nuance and the complexity. But at a third of the price. I think that I personally drink a ton of Cru Beaujolais. It's what I have in my cellar, and it's some of the I always want to drink Burgundy, but can't generally afford it. So, but Beaujolais, you can open up, and again, like the best, just the absolute best version of it, any night of the week, and not feel too bad about that.
Yeah, and you know, it's fairly simple to master. There's only 10 crews that you need to figure out, and then a bunch of producers, and you know, and it's not like Burgundy, which demands fealty and obeisance and study and cap off, and you still don't get it right. I still don't understand Burgundy. You know, no matter how much I try, I can't. I get rewarded and spanked in the same session, which is not bad. You know, who doesn't like to get rewarded and spanked the same time? but getting back to Beaujolais, it's like Gamay. Plus, I just love Gamay. And last night, I can't remember the name of the producer, but somebody threw a bottle from the Cote Rouennaise. It's kind of, they consider it the Loire, but it's in the central massif, right mm-hmm. in the middle of France. You know, people forget that the Loire starts in the middle of France and then goes north and then west and then dumps out into the Atlantic. But this was just, a crazy, delicious, it sort of had one foot in the Rhone and one foot in the Loire by way of Beaujolais, but it wasn't Beaujolais. I mean, phew, fantastic. And I'm a total freak for taking these wines, and you've got to chill these wines. When I was down in Florida for South Beach, it was a revelation to people who live in Miami that you should chill red wines below room temperature. And the rooms down there were like 72 to 80 degrees. People were spontaneously combusting. They have a glass of, some massive red. They go outside in the sun. They explode in flames. It's just, it's terrible. So of course, room temperature before centrally heated rooms. You know, you're talking about 55, 60 degrees.
That's right. That's
nothing
right.
Tastes good at ambient 72. Not Yoo-Hoo, Orange Knee-High, Diet Dr. Pepper, Frappuccinos, Cappuccinos. Nothing tastes good at that temperature. You know, you either got to go above or below. And now that this coffee is good, by the way. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Roberta's.
I'm getting hopped up. I'm getting pistol whipped on this stuff. I could use a glass of Gamay right now, just like they do. You know, the first time I went to Lyon, mm-hmm. you see all the taxi drivers. They're up at the bars. You know, they're having their little cup of coffee, their little, demi-tasse. And then they're drinking a little pot of Beaujolais. It's just insane.
And when you chill it, it has that same kind of quaffable, sessionable aspect that those delicious, sparkling wines do. You can just knock back. That is actually, I just got very nervous that they're going to go back in the car and drive.
One foot on the gas, one foot on the brakes. Geez. You know, it's what can I tell
you? We're going to take just a quick break, and then we'll be back shortly with Joshua Wesson.
Thank you.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. The following is an actor reading an actual customer email from Heritage Foods USA.
My family and I enjoyed the Heritage turkey. It was far superior to the regular mass-produced turkeys in terms of flavor and texture. Absolutely delicious and worth the difference in price. We will never go back to the regular turkeys. It made our holidays more enjoyable. Thank you, Heritage Foods USA.
Heritage Foods USA hopes you had a great holiday season. For more specials on pork, beef, and other meats, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com.
And we're back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm here with Josh Wesson, and we're just talking about some of Josh's favorite discoveries and rediscoveries of Beaujolais. But I want to change gears just a little bit and go back to the time when you first started working in restaurants and you got your first sommelier job. Can you tell us a little bit about how that all happened?
Well, my first somm job wasn't a full on somm job because there weren't somms back then. I mean, this is Roger de Gorne era when there were three sommeliers in New York City, and before that, I got my start in the serious restaurant business at a restaurant called Panache in Boston. It was on Main Street in the shadow of MIT, next to Joyce Chen's. And this was when Nouvelle Cuisine was just breaking over the shores of the United States in the late 70s, early 80s. And I got the job there because I told the chef, Bruce Frankel, that I could install his toilets. He was building out this little, tiny, 32-seat storefront restaurant. He had done a stage in La Meloise in Chagny. He had gone to Cordon Bleu in Paris with his girlfriend. And they were really enthused about doing Nouvelle Cuisine food in Boston, where there were no examples, really, at that time. And I bought a Time Life book on plumbing. I put in his bathroom. I helped him stucco the walls. We illegally wired the place. And we opened up this restaurant. There were five of us. And it was open for dinner 6 nights a week, Monday through Saturday, and then brunch on Sunday. So it was this one dysfunctional, happy family. We were working 7 days a week, 50 weeks a year. And for the first 6 months while we were waiting for the wine license to come in Cambridge, people would it was a BYO. And it was Julia Child's favorite restaurant. She would come and dine there once a week with Paul, her husband. And she would bring in the most wonderful wines. And everybody would leave the wines. When you go to a BYO, usually you bring more than you need. And you just drink it. You leave whatever's left there for the staff. That's where I learned about wine. And when we finally got our wine license, I put a really fantastic little list together of 30 bottles. It's very hard to do a 30-bottle list. I don't care what kind of food you're crafting a list for, because it's just the old saw. It's hard to write a short story, much easier to write a long one. Hard to write a short letter. You know, you've got to edit. You've got to really think about what's necessary and what's not. And this restaurant at Panache changed all the time. The chef was constantly embracing different aspects of Nouvelle Cuisine, and because it was really just exploding at that time, it hadn't defined itself. And for me, every month was like working in a different restaurant. I learned about matching wine and food on the front lines by experientially playing with things, by trial and error. I didn't have a group of people to work with. I didn't have a school that I could study at. I didn't have a degree program that I could take. None of that existed. I'm talking about 1979, 1980. And then I went off to study public health. And shrink livers for a living instead of enlarge them. And I saw the light after that, quickly gave that up, came down to New York, fell in with the folks at the Quilted Giraffe, and Bill Guilfoyle took me under his wing. He was the somm there, one of the three or four working somms in New York. And, and the rest, as they say, is grape-stained history.
And when do you see the change to having three or four somms in New York to today, where there's this sommelier culture, where there's tons of sommeliers? So what do you think were some of the factors that led to that change, and how do you see that happening?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the rise of training programs, of being able to you know, have a form of certification for some, so they can have a path to righteousness. But there's a critical mass of mouths that didn't exist back when I was, in the restaurant business. And when you have all of these people to form a community, you can do all sorts of things that you could never have imagined doing without that critical mass. And, you know, the greatest thing about today's Psalms is that they don't really consider themselves to be Psalms. I mean, they are in name, but they're more than that. They're so much more than that. They're teachers. They're students. They're patrons. They are chefs. They are passionate. They're winemakers. They're doing so many different things in so many different ways. And what they're doing is creating this irresistible enthusiasm for wine in the proper context. And the context is your life, no matter what you're doing. You don't have to be a formal student of wine and food. I love that you go to so many restaurants, no matter where you are now, in New York, for that matter, all over the United States. You go to any place where people take food seriously, and you'll find interesting things happening with wine and wine. Because when I was down in Miami, Allegra Angelo's the wine director for 50 Eggs that has Yardbird, and they just opened up a Thai restaurant, a fantastic Thai restaurant called Kong River House. And I worked with the chef there, Chef B, to do a wine and Thai seminar. And she was working with me, and we did all sparkling wines, 5 wildly different sparkling wines with all of these great little Thai dishes. And, you know, she's not a Psalm in the formal sense of the term, but she's teaching her staff. She's working with the people that she's buying wine from. She's getting her employees across the board enthused, and of course the customers are going crazy for it. She's on a 100 bottle list. She's got 30 sparkling wines in this Thai restaurant, and it's just off the charts delicious. I mean, it's crazy. I couldn't have imagined that taking place when I was growing up in the business. And she's not, you know, formally certified, but it doesn't matter. In her head, she's doing things that, you know, were, you know, unimaginable in my time, but are brilliant right now. And this is the golden era of wine drinking, of learning about wine, of working in restaurants. I mean, I couldn't imagine a better time to be doing what we're doing, and especially what you're doing. And it's one of the reasons why I have endless admiration for you, because you're constantly pushing the envelope and doing things. Every one of your businesses is building on the wisdom of the prior one. You're standing on your own shoulders. It's very cool. I have endless admiration for what you're doing, and you haven't even done your best work yet.
I'm truly honored that you would say that. Thank you. I did want to talk about bestsellers, which some of your best work. Something that I think a lot of people know you for, the wine retail store that was really really looked at wine in a different way from the way that most people did at the time. Tell us what made you decide to open up that store, and tell us all about it.
Well, Bestsellers was an idea rattling around my head for a number of years. I opened the first store in November of 1996. On the Upper East Side of Manhattan on Lexington between 86th and 87th Street. But the idea was born of my experience in restaurants, where you have about 2 minutes to talk to someone about what their palate preferences are, and then you have to play interlocutor and connect what your customers' expressed preferences are with your own wine list, and what they're eating, and how much they want to spend. Mm-hmm. You sort of perform this calculus, and you come up with a bottle that you hope will please them. And I wanted to create a store that functioned as a sommelier. Basically, a wine list that you could walk through, and you would be directed towards a bottle that would have a high likelihood of pleasing you. Now, everybody in the world of everybody who drinks wine knows what they like. They may not be able to express that in a highly articulate way, or they may not be able to connect to a given bottle, but they know what they like. We all know what we like. We know what we like in terms of coffee. We know what we like in terms of cereal and yogurt, and we certainly know what we like in terms of wine. And if you can find a way of reducing those expressed preferences to a couple of words and then laying wines out according to those expressed preferences, you can find a way to bridge people's tastes with what's inside a bottle. The problem with wine, the greatest problem with wine, is there's a 2-inch piece of tree bark that usually separates you from experiencing it. It's not like going to a cheese counter where you can point and say, I don't know anything about that cheese, but if I try it, I'll tell you thumbs up or thumbs down whether I like it. But when it comes to wine, you've got to rely on somebody else's blessing.
Right. And so if you were to look at a bottle and said, Domaine Sorolle from the Côte Rouennaise, people probably won't know what that tastes like, but in your shop, there'll be a section that would have said light juicy reds. Is that kind of the idea?
Well, By the way, that's the Côte Rouennaise that I had. It's Skernik wine.
Yes.
And it's fantastic. And it was just absolutely.
I think that's one of Daniel's selections, Daniel Johnson.
Insanely delicious. But, you know, here's what I did. The stores, bestseller stores, were laid out by taste categories, 8 of them. Mm-hmm. Simple. You didn't need to have any experience with wine. You didn't need to have a dictionary, a glossary. You just needed to look at the fizzy, fresh, soft, luscious, juicy, smooth, big, and sweet signs, and you would have been directed towards a wine that probably would have pleased you. Fizzy for sparkling wine, fresh for light-bodied whites, soft for medium-bodied whites, luscious for full-bodied whites. We did the same thing for reds. Juicy was light-bodied, smooth, medium-bodied reds, and then big for full-bodied reds, mm-hmm. and of course, sweet was sweet. Anybody can understand that. You add colors to those words and icons that represent those words. For big, we had a giant sun. For sweet, lollipops. For juicy, cherries. And suddenly, the world of wine becomes a multiple choice test instead of an essay question. What are you going to have with chicken or pizza or hamburgers or grilled tuna? And everybody loves multiple choice tests. Nobody likes an essay question, you know, because you have a good shot at getting a multiple choice question right. And that's what I did with bestsellers. It was very simple. I was reductive, but not to the point of dumbing down wine, just to the point where anybody, whether you're an expert or an initiate, would be able to feel comfortable shopping for wine.
I agree. And I think that when a sommelier is really doing their job, they're making people feel comfortable about indulging and enjoying wine. And it seems that shop really did express that. And that's really, really cool. And you don't get that when you walk into most retail stores.
Well, the other thing that I did back in 1996, which I thought was pretty smart, and still today I do, all the wines when we opened were $10 or less. So the price range was $5 to $10 at retail, which meant that it was an impulse purchase. The whole store was an impulse purchase. You didn't have to calculate, should I pay a little bit extra? I don't really have that money. I'm not sure if I could afford. Everything in the store was open to you because everybody could afford a $5 to $10 bottle. We raised the ceiling to $15 over the course of the years, and now it's sort of bumping at $20. But, you know, that accounting for inflation, it's still $5 to $10. It's still an impulse purchase. And I firmly believe that you don't need to spend a lot of money to extract a lot of pleasure from a bottle of wine. There's no direct relationship, no linear connection to the amount of money that you spend and the pleasure that you receive. And once you understand that, once you're freed from, you know, believing that the more you spend, the more you get, then you can wander the culinary universe and the experience things for what they truly are, and decide for yourself what's delicious and what's not.
Yeah, what do you think? What is the least expensive, most pleasurable wine you've had?
Well, you know, boy, the least expensive wine.
In my philosophy, that there is a bottom. There's a point where when a wine is so inexpensive that there's something that's got to be wrong. Either they're doing something terrible to the environment. There's some like slave labor situation going on. Like that, there's no way that the grapes could be made with any kind of care. At some point, and I still haven't determined for myself what I think that point is, but I think that in terms of retail, for me, maybe $10 now might be my low point.
You can't. I mean, let's face it. You know, different places that produce wine have different economies that will, you know, impact what a wine's ultimate price will be at retail. Right now, Argentina is producing some of the greatest values in the world. And you can find at retail between $7 and $10 mm-hmm. some very credible delicious, easy to drink wines, Torrontes, Malbecs, blends, Bonardas, you know, that are just fun to drink and don't cost more than $10. And I'm a big fan of bag-in-the-box wines. I love this technology that allows you, first of all, it's green.
It's brilliant.
The wines last. I mean, how many times have you opened a bottle and you don't finish it? And even if you vacuum it or stick it in the fridge, the next day it's not going to be quite as good. Maybe it'll be two-thirds as good or three-quarters as good, sometimes half as good. But it's not going to be as good. But when you get into a box wine, and better wines are being put into boxes, you know, you can tap that thing, and those wines will last 30, 45, 60 days. It's fantastic. And I'm completely enamored of it. I think it's absolutely part of our future. And because you're saving money by putting it into a plastic bladder rather than a glass bottle, and then you don't have to ship it, you know, at least incur the charges for shipping something that's heavy, you can build that savings into the price. And then, you know, the equivalent of $6, $7 a bottle in a box, good wines in there.
Yeah, brilliant wines. That is such a good point, you know. I think there's still an image issue with bag-in-the-box wines that people probably will take a little while to get over. But once it's in your glass, you can't tell anymore.
you can't, you know, like, I mean, well, Jenny and Francois, you know, the importers of natural wines, biodynamic, organic, they just came out with, it's a bag-in-a-box, but it's truly a box. It's a wooden box. It's super cool. And the white, I think, comes from the Paydock. But they have a Cote de Rhone in there, which is a completely delicious wine. I mean, it's just fantastic. I would take that anywhere. That's a wine that you could take to a somm party and give people glasses of, and, you know, not be in any way ashamed of what's going into people's mouths. I mean, fantastic wines.
That's really exciting. There's a new technology that's a little bit higher end than that called Coravan. I don't know if you've seen this yet, but
I haven't.
It basically replicates the large system where people would put a bottle in into one of these. What are the enomatic systems, and you could pour out one glass, and it puts the argon gas in it, and it keeps it for days and days and days, or months even. You put it on top of the bottle. It's very cool. You put it on top of the bottle. You can pour out one glass. It caps it up, and then you can keep that for months. And that's a very cool technology
that's genius.
To.
You know, I mean, there are a lot of things you can do that are very smart in order to save wine, and that sounds like the smartest. But I tell people, if let's say you're going away, you know, you open up a bottle and then you're leaving for the weekend, you don't want to lose the bottle, pour it into an ice cube tray, freeze the wine, and then take it out of the ice cube tray and put it into a freezer bag. And the next time you need to cook with wine, you pull out ice cubes from there. And you don't have to open up a bottle just to get a cup to go into your coq au vin or whatever you're making. And the wine's perfectly intact. Have you ever frozen wine and then thawed it out? It actually will not diminish it as much as you might imagine.
That's brilliant. I haven't thought. And, you know, I've actually been doing a little bit more cooking at home with my girlfriend, and we're doing these old Julia Child recipes. We made boeuf bourguignon last weekend.
Oh, you made a boeuf bourguignon?
Yeah.
Well, that's extraordinary. You know, I really like to take the cubes of meat and sear them a little bit before I put them in the pot. It makes all the difference in the world. I channel her every now and then.
That was impressive. That was truly, truly impressive. I'm totally going to use that ice cube trick. But Josh West, where can we find you next speaking? Where if our listeners want to come see you, and where can we find you next? What are you up to next?
Well, I mean, I'm doing a bunch of interesting things now. I'm picking the wines for JetBlue. That's a blast. They're low-fare sommelier. I mean, the cheapest date in the year. You know, it's
yet another reason to fly JetBlue. I love JetBlue. I wish I could fly them everywhere.
Here's the dark secret about JetBlue. You know, the snacks are free.
Yeah.
But if you go to a bodega and you see how much, you know, Terra Blue chips are, they're about $2 a bag. So if you stuff enough into your, like, carry-on, you can actually make money. You can have a net profit flying on JetBlue. Just take all the snacks, stick them in there, you know, and you'll be fine. But in point of fact, it's been fun for me to play with them, because we're very simpatico in terms of the way we look at wine and life and value. We want to exceed people's expectations, take a commodity and decommodify it in the process, giving it some added value that's unique. I'm working with Fairway now, doing really cool things with their wine shops in Pelham Manor and Stamford and out in Woodland Park, New Jersey, and pairing wines and foods with lots of things. I mean, it's just Fairway is just a lot of fun. It's, to me, it's a kid in a candy store. I love them and I love their food. I love working with them. I'm going to be opening up a restaurant in 2013 called Slider Bar, where I'm repurposing little sandwiches, artisanal sandwiches, sort of taking, you know, these virtuously sourced ingredients and turning them into wickedly delicious little bites.
Everyone loves a sandwich. I think that if everyone realized that every culture pretty much has a sandwich, we could all be friends. Because we all do. We can all come together, except for the gluten-free people. But we could all come together around the fact that we all do truly love sandwiches. This is a brilliant idea.
Well, we're going to have gluten-free buns, so we're not going to leave anybody out of the big tent.
Yes, all-inclusive.
And Michelle Nishan is my chef, you know, and the food is insanely good. We're looking for space now. I think we'll be open in about 6 months, and it being February, so you know, do the math on when we might be opening. We're probably going to do two in 2013. We're hoping to. And we want to do what Meatball Shop did for meatballs. You know, meatballs are ubiquitous. They took this simple food and they repurposed it to a higher level of deliciousness. No reason why you can't do that with Little Sammy's, you know.
I ate a meatball shop last night.
I wish they had better wine. You know, that's the one thing.
You know what? They our Pepe Valtellina Rosso, $62, 2009 on the list.
Really?
And they had Crochet, Lucien Crochet Sancerre for like $48.
Well, they finally jacked it up because when they opened, they didn't have
this
those good
true.
Ones on there.
I sent Michael a text. Nice job. Thanks. Anyway, Josh Weston, thank you so much. It's been a blast chatting with you as always. I look forward to seeing you soon and look out for Slider Bar in the fall.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.